Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is part 2 of episode 19, where we revisited a Carnegie Mellon School series discussing a paper by James March on knowledge exploration and exploitation. To find out more, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. If you haven't listened to part 1 yet, please go and do so now, as this is a direct continuation of that discussion, as usual. And now back to the conversation.
In part 1, we've talked about the basics of the model, the simplified model that March presents in the article, as well as some of our concerns about how he constructed the model and its features. And then we went on from there to review organizational learning from an internal perspective, or intra-organizational learning. Now we're going to proceed to a more open system view of learning, particularly focus on competition, which is a new factor that March introduces into the model and the implications of the organizational learning that have greater implications for the organizations involved. And then we're going to come towards the end of the article, and besides reviewing some of the conclusions, we're going to think about, or at least give our view of, how useful we thought the article was with the model.
Or so we think. We'll see.
Yes, how it goes. Well, at least what our perspective is.
Right. So kind of picking up where we left off, the second type of organizational learning that March talks about here is to do with learning between organizations. So we discussed learning within. So this is about learning between in a competitive environment. So kind of taking the same basic model, but applying it in a situation where organizations compete, kind of how that affects the distribution between exploration and exploitation.
Right, and on some, they're compared on some kind of performance dimension. He doesn't specify what that is, but that's...
I think it's general performance.
Yes, I agree.
As in efficiency.
Yes.
Basically. Okay. Efficiency of resource use. And because we are basically dealing with the problem of how much resource to allocate to exploration versus exploitation, or the other way around.
Right.
I think that basically what that alludes to. And spoiler alert, the conclusion of the model is that organizations need to display some kind of ambidexterity with regards to exploration and exploitation.
Yes.
Because he draws some interesting parallels and conclusions, and one of them is that organizations may alter the competitive landscape in the direction of knowledge exploration, but I think not the other way around. So the organization that kind of ups the ante in terms of gaining new knowledge, which can be quite disruptive to the industry as a whole, can transform the competitive landscape in a way that other organizations will have to invest more resources into knowledge exploration. And that will basically turn the whole environment into this sort of a biotech sector, where you mainly allocate resources to generating these blockbuster knowledges, so to speak, at the expense of actually applying what you learned across a broad spectrum of the organization.
Right. He has a good quote on page 81, or there's a good line at page 81 where he says, "This is in the environment you're talking about is where returns to one competitor are not strictly determined by that competitor's own performance, but depend on the relative standing of the competitors, and returns to changes in knowledge depend not only on the magnitude of the changes in the expected value, but also on changes in variability and the number of competitors." So that's, I think that's what he's foreshadowing there.
Right. And because the environment has an element of evolution or change of some sort, he was talking about turbulence previously, and knowledge exploitation leads to competency trap, kind of the premium here is on getting new knowledge into the game, essentially.
Right.
Which is, I guess, another assumption that maybe is not wholly applicable everywhere. I mean, certainly a whole bunch of different people, including theorists like Taylor and Fayol, the early guys, they would not place a premium on knowledge exploration at the expense of exploitation, because their whole prerogative was the opposite, that efficiency is achieved through exploitation of knowledge.
Yeah, I would say a little bit of both. I would say I wouldn't put Taylor all the way over in the exploitation category. Maybe I'm seeing it the wrong way, but one of the things he emphasized was scientific method to identify the best way. And there are, so I think that's a bit of a nod of the hat to the need for exploration. But I do agree with you, though the vast majority of the Taylorism is focused around, and certainly the way people interpret it is around exploitation. Well, you know, once you have that knowledge, but Taylor did acknowledge that there was some exploration necessary to identify that one best way.
I guess that's true. Yeah, I can certainly concede that. We do see Taylor slightly in different terms, in different aspects of his
right.
work.
Well, it just shows that there's some nuance to Taylor. I'm not disagreeing with you. I think, and I was just saying, just expand a little bit. I think March has another good statement here that reflects what you're talking about and does it very well. And this is a short sentence. He writes on in the bottom of page 83, the question is whether you can do exceptionally well, as opposed to better than average, without leaving the confines of conventional actions or actions. Or so that's the question. You know, that's the question. It doesn't really answer the question, but it always, actually does say the answer is, you know, he says on the next page, the answer is complicated, which indeed it is.
He does actually on the same page also mention that there is a type of osmosis that's present.
Yes.
That some learning processes increase both average performance and variability, and variability is basically exploration here.
Yes.
It's already getting confusing.
Yes. Well, now, one observation I'd like to make here that I was thinking about in the first part of our conversation, but I think it applies better here. We do see organizations today, and I don't think they were as well known to March when he was writing as they are now, and like Toyota. And Toyota takes exploitation and exploration and to a new level where they spend a lot of time or a lot of their focus is on exploiting existing knowledge better, but they also identify new knowledge and propagate it throughout the organization more effectively than many of their competitors. And in many ways, you could look at Toyota as an organization that learns more effectively than others, and that there's a lot of learning and exploring that goes on through the exploitation. So it's really hard to say, well, if you find a better way to bolt in seats in a car so it's faster and more efficient, is that pure exploitation? Are there some aspects of understanding and analyzing the problem that are created that are also a form of exploration? So we don't necessarily need to debate it here. I just thought it was interesting that Toyota is a bit of a hybrid of those things.
I think another term can be thrown in to kind of clarify this, and that being the difference in the degree of exploration. And namely, your example would be incremental exploration.
Yes.
As opposed to radical exploration.
Yes, that's a good way to look at it.
But Marsh doesn't make such nuanced distinctions between...
No.
It's all very much on the level of these absolutes, that
yes.
There is knowledge or no knowledge, there is learning or no learning, but there isn't
yes.
much nuance in with respect to either of those. So, of course, when you read this, in any case, I won't speak for you or anyone else, but when I read this, and I read things like some types of exploration also have effects and impact on performance, I kind of think of what you mentioned, the incremental stuff, where you kind of discover slightly different ways of doing things that are maybe a little bit new, but not drastically so. But in other places, you kind of imagine these breakthroughs and very radical, very disruptive discoveries that perhaps he's alluding to. But there's no way to know because it doesn't say, and we kind of just end up assuming things, really.
Well, and I think it's okay for the reader to just decide. You know, my social science background says it's okay for the reader or the organization to decide. Because what I was thinking about when you were talking about the kind of incremental incremental improvement or incremental exploration. I saw a demonstration one time of how NASCAR changes tires. So NASCAR, for readers who aren't familiar, is high performance racing around a track in the United States. And they, you know, very fast cars. And so the time you spend changing tires or getting fuel is very important because it's a source of advantage. And I saw an explanation one time where they showed how through a series of incremental improvements, they actually decided to rethink how they change the tires. I mean, you think it's pretty basic stuff, and I would have thought so too, but I saw this process that some of the teams went through where, in essence, it's a wholly different operation than the path they were going down for reducing variability, because that in that same page 83, March assumes that this exploitation reduces variability, and because you're just doing things better and better. And so there was a case where it was a radical departure. At a certain point, they achieved a radical departure because they rethought their understanding of how to change tires. And so I think that, you know, that might happen in biotechnology and other areas as well. It's just there's a very concrete example.
Interesting example, because it's basically exploration achieved through exploitation.
Yes, yes.
So they didn't fall into the competency trap as is predicted here.
Right.
By doing the same thing, they still managed to improve the overall process by kind of improving the different particulars of the process.
Right, and in fact, that's a lot of what's a part of the fundamental structure of the Toyota learning process. Is now that I've read Simon, I can now say that helps them avoid falling into the competency trap, the way Toyota's approach to knowledge and developing new knowledge. And that's something I wouldn't have thought about until I read this article.
Yeah, but the thing is that this is not possible within this article because
you
mentioned previously. Basically, by making one of the assumptions that we discussed in part one, that changes on one level does not cause or necessitate or even impact knowledge at any other level or dimension or any of those, the NASCAR example would not be possible in a world like that.
I agree. Yeah. Absolutely.
So something to be mindful of, this nested and interconnected nature of the processes and the practices and how the organizations work.
Yes.
It may not lend itself well to modeling stuff, but I mean, clearly it's fundamental. So one of the, kind of following up on that, one of the things that Marge is trying to propose here is that, okay, so how do you mitigate this issue where you are likely to compromise reliability by spending too much resources on knowledge exploration? Because, you know, the more resources are poured into exploration, fewer there are for exploitation, and that can end up making an organization kind of top heavy, I guess, where no benefit is achieved through all this new knowledge that may be being discovered. So one of the things he says is that what you can do is split the exploration effort into multiple independent projects. So instead of the whole organization going all in and concentrating this huge effort into exploring one area of interest, for example, he suggests, hey, let's just split it into multiple sub-entities and let them go and explore many different alternatives, and that kind of maximizes the chances of maybe finding something that's not a complete waste of time, which is, of course, the ultimate concern of exploring new knowledge, that it may not turn out to be anything.
Well, yeah, and one thing I'd like to point out there is that that's often called, in the practitioner's world, those can be called pilot projects, where you're not trying to get everything all solved all at one time or take huge amounts of risk. So I mean, to use the analogy you used earlier, where it's kind of an incremental approach to exploration, maybe not through exploitation, but you're taking smaller risks because you're doing it in smaller parts.
Right. And also in this way, you can explore different facets of the same thing,
right?
For example, and maybe through some kind of a coordinated lessons learned process, actually gain some insight that otherwise could have been missed. And this is interesting because a project-based knowledge exploration is actually a big thing.
Yes.
And there is a lot of literature that deals with exactly this thing, that projects are fantastically good at generating new knowledge. And there's many ways why they do that and how they proceed in exploring things, and how projects are a good way for very structured, kind of bureaucratized organizations to break through the red tape to explore something new that otherwise would may not have been possible because of either silos or delineated departments or anything like that. But something that Marge does not necessarily foreshadow here, and that emerged later, that I think is kind of worth mentioning, is that whilst projects are very good at knowledge exploration within them, because of all this thing about breaking boundaries and traversing different ways of seeing things that people may have, they are very, very bad at transmitting what they have learned, the knowledge that they have explored, to the wider organization or between one another. So while it does perhaps kind of spread out the risk and increase variability without compromising reliability, it doesn't necessarily facilitate any increase in exploitation, because it has been showed time and time again that projects are not well suited to applying the explored knowledge to be exploited, essentially.
Right, because that diffusion of knowledge is a very big challenge. And I would argue that the practitioner term for that would be there's no free lunch, right? You get this great opportunity to innovate within this small microcosm of the company or the people, and it's easier to break down barriers, as you were talking about. But that doesn't change the difficulty of then propagating that new knowledge and that what's been explored throughout the rest of the organization. So the difficulty still remains. You're still getting yourself a chance to explore things, but that challenge of the diffusion doesn't go away.
Because there's two situations where that can happen. Whether, I think as in the case with this article, that you have an organization and then they create a project to explore stuff, and then the challenges of disseminating knowledge diffusing knowledge from the project into the bigger body of the organization, it doesn't go away. It's still the same as it was before. The boundaries of authority, the different epistemic boundaries, the pragmatic incompatibilities between different parts of the organization, all that sort of thing. But then there's a situation where, and this is kind of popular these days, where the entire organization is a collection of temporary projects. So the so-called project-based organization, or the project organization even. And some examples of these are, for instance, management consultancies, or even construction, where you have the entire work of the company is based on just doing these very discrete projects that have a finite time span of completion, and there is no kind of a core of the organization which exists in parallel to that.
Right, the movie making industry is very similar.
Yeah, that's actually, there's this classic paper by Arthur and De Filippi where they look exactly at making films, that a film is made and the organization essentially no longer exists after the film has been made. So that's a very different situation, and perhaps for a different discussion as well. But I think it's worth noting in this context, because we're talking about knowledge exploration. And in this case, there are challenges to apply the explored knowledge to be exploited by the organization. But there are many cases where there is no bigger organization to benefit from the explored knowledge, and is just left to the individuals and to how they apply that in the future, which of course is a different challenge, because then they are only part of the exploration process. They do not, you can't basically take this knowledge thing that is presumed in this model and kind of move it to the bigger body, because each individual member of the exploratory group then, you know, doesn't have the complete understanding of what and how has been explored. And that's a huge challenge in the exploitation process.
Well, not only that, so I agree with you there. And the other feature is, so take the example of management consultancy, right? We're doing this kind of work, and they're exploring new ideas, and they're learning things and putting in some database. So let's presume you solve the problem of getting people to use the database and identify what the lessons learned were for previous projects or the insights. Then another challenge exists that March doesn't really address, and that is this idea of, well, what's the context of the new project? How do you, it's seldom the case where you can just copy exactly what was done before. You then, a lot of judgment and expertise and experience involved in adapting what was learned previously to this new project context. And I think you were talking about things like that. I just wanted to emphasize that a little bit more.
I think there's also this idea that is kind of like I think it's a missed opportunity in the paper. It's something that isn't really discussed further. But the idea of how radical this exploration needs to be, or how radical it's viewed. So if you go back to the example of businesses, you could have ideas that are so radical that they actually represent a new business, because I don't know, it would cause problems in terms of corporate identity to have it within the same organization. I don't know. I still struggle with this very simplistic view of the world. So I know that within the purposes of the model, a lot of things have been simplified to the bone. But in reality, it is something that takes place. Even if you think of a lot of startups that kind of like pitch out for funding and see if someone believes in them, if someone thinks the idea is worthwhile. There's a lot of additional examples that can kind of enrich the general arguments, let's put it that way.
Well, what made me think of, Miranda, I was going to ask you, from an entrepreneurial aspect, right? So you have there's this aspect of entrepreneurs, or one, starting on their own to do something new. And then you have this aspect of entrepreneurs doing something and then getting purchased or absorbed. I hate to use that expression, but, you know, bought by some larger company because they want the innovative ideas. I mean, do you see stuff like that in the research, where that's a big challenge, where the entrepreneurial firm has this way of thinking and doing business, and then they have this a clash of cultures or difficulty with the larger organization that buys them?
Yeah, definitely there are problems of this kind. I think that there's a general greater complexity of the world than what is presented in this paper. So definitely there are issues with identity. But again, this can also be in a positive sense. So you have this idea of synergies between firms.
Because, you know, if we go to identity and synergy and...
You open up a lot of things, I do realize.
Yeah, and not many of them have nothing to do with the knowledge explicitly, which is, of course, the topic of this work.
So one of the things that was occurring to me on page 84, where he's talking about a competition for relative position and strategic action, we're talking about this competitors aspect. He says he's talking about the means of performance and distributions, you know, that sort of stuff. But the last sentence of the second to last paragraph on the page, he says, similarly, in the short run, variations in the reliability of performance can be seen as choices of knowledge or risk that can be set willfully within the range of available alternatives. That's kind of a big assumption. So even though I get bothered about this idea about these choices of knowledge thing, it does give some inkling of the kinds of issues that you have to think about when you have competitors and the reliability of the performance. And I have a question about how explicitly that people are able to choose stuff like that, but I do think it's an interesting feature that he identifies.
It basically says that knowledge exploration is not a free-for-all thing where anyone can go and just explore anything at almost a random probability. It kind of is reminiscent of this notion in institutional theory of basically isomorphism, where where organizations converge on certain ways of doing things. And this is, I think this alludes to that, that essentially if your competitor is exploring something and it's proving to be interesting, then in all likelihood, other organizations, competitors will follow suit. And maybe this is what he means when he speaks earlier about the environment leaving behind unchanging organizations that are stuck in this competency trap, that essentially people all go off in looking, exploring some knowledge, you know, a knowledge essentially, and you're just kind of left making your BlackBerries when everyone else is using touchscreen iPhones.
Right. Well, and so to give a real world example, some of our listeners may be familiar with the Moneyball book that was written by Michael Lewis that talked about a baseball team that was taking a completely different approach to analyzing performance and selecting players and that sort of thing. It was very successful. I think in the early, what I think the British call the Aughties, right? 00 to 09 timeframe. And that now you see that team, even though he's run by the same person, Billy Beane, is not as successful. And there are some people that think that the ideas that we're advocating in the book, taking this more analytical approach to player development and talent identification, are now very widespread in baseball, and therefore the competitive advantage is gone. There's been a convergence of this. There was this wide variability at one point. Now there's been this convergence in many features of how that's applied. So I think there is something to be said that a lot of times you can have this great competitive advantage, and initially. But then people can find out what you're doing, and it's hard to keep all that stuff a secret. And in fact, some people asked some number of years after the book Moneyball was published why he was so open about the source of great competitive advantage that at the time the baseball team had. And his answer was something along the lines of, well, I didn't think anybody else would do it. It was such a radical departure from what other teams were doing. Didn't think it was likely they would adopt these strategies, which turned out not to be the case.
The film with Brad Pitt and Jonah something is actually very good about this. But yeah, that's an example of when exploration yields a beneficial outcome, and then it's exploited by you know, everyone else eventually, kind of moving the environment forward.
Right.
And Lawrence and Lorsch alluded to that we looked at in episode 15, when the environment is moving forward. Well, not forward, just moving essentially from where it was. And it's kind of alluded to here briefly.
An interesting, well, it could be a wrap-up point if you agree, but I think we could kind of reflect on how can we find this piece of work useful nowadays in the current situation? I get the importance of the problem and this kind of like juxtaposition between exploitation, exploration, and how there is a need for a fine balance between them. So that is one thing that I'm totally in support of. I do struggle with this simplistic view of the world, and I'd like to color it a bit more. That is something that I stated from the beginning. It was something that struck me as important to the work. Then I don't know. I see a lot of things missing. I see a lot of parts of reality that you know, the founding of new businesses or spin outs, or I don't know, a lot of things that I'm I like to see as part of the model, but obviously it's not the purpose of it.
No, and it does, I guess, a significant value of this is that it does generate a lot of that discussion.
Of course.
The publication, yeah. But I agree generally. I find myself more enthused in discussing the assumptions on which the model is based than the actual results and the process of the model, to be honest, because I struggle to translate those into any kind of any kind of an illustrative experience, mm-hmm. you know. I think much like you, I don't see well how this would apply in a useful way in an empirical situation. But I guess I see what they were, what he was trying to do by it. And it goes back, I think, a little bit to the comment I made at the beginning where I said that it seems retro-engineered.
Mm-hmm.
And I still kind of think that, I don't know if that was the case or not. James Marsh never told us. But it almost seems that he had this message to transmit about the importance of exploration and exploitation, and this was one of the vehicles through which he could do this in a way that that would have been legitimate enough to be heard widely. But in terms of the actual model, I think it's hard to tell whether it increased or enhanced my understanding of knowledge management and organizational learning, because of course if I was coming into this as the model is from zero, maybe it would have or it wouldn't have. It's hard to tell from now, knowing all I know. But at this stage, if I had to read and teach this, possibly, I think it's more confusing than clarifying, simply because of the lack of differentiation between what knowledge is or may be, and just a very kind of linear binary application of it to these very sweeping situations with no differentiation in context. Or there is some mention of technology, but it's very limited, or individual capabilities or anything like that, basically, that that we understand now to be a very important part of the organizational complexity. So I don't know, it's not been easy discussing this, certainly in terms of staying within the model, within the paper.
It was a challenge, yeah.
Well, I share the concerns both of you have, and in my personal perspective is, if it wasn't for if it wasn't for the fact that we made this the focus of the podcast, this is the kind of article I actually usually wouldn't read, or wouldn't go very far past the description of the model, because I would just dismiss it very quickly for the reasons Miranda started out with and you continued, Demetrius. And then through the nature of our conversations and thinking a little bit more about it, because I will tell you, this podcast is one I probably wrote the least amount of notes for, or this article, the least amount of notes for, because I was so dissatisfied with the model.
Yeah, and then I have lots of question marks. And
and I did. I got question marks on the PDF and that sort of thing. And then I started thinking, well, to the extent the model identifies, and I share your concern, Demetrius, that maybe he reverse engineered the model from the conclusions that he already had, which seems possible. And then I started thinking about, even though I also don't struggle to see whether there's practical ways this model could be developed through empirical means, I do think it's interesting that he identifies some of the natures of the things that are involved, right? So the real question comes down to this, whether if you think the article is or isn't interesting, you really have to say, okay, do I think the flaws in the model, you know, the gap between what we think is the reality out there and the simplifications of the model, do we think those are fatal for some of the conclusions that he reaches in the article? Or do you think it's not meant to have, or it wasn't his intention, or maybe I shouldn't say that, but that it's not necessary to have this strong correspondence with reality? Because I don't think you could model that. I mean, I think we talked about that. A lot of these things that we're talking about are not model. You couldn't model them really, or at least not in a meaningful way. And therefore, do you think those deficiencies mean that the discussion of the things you have to think about, right? He doesn't tell you how to do it. He just says, these are these considerations you have to have, whether that's still valid, you know. And I don't know. I mean, I do know, I haven't been a practitioner for many years. These are the kind, some of these things are the kinds of things you think about, but that one of the big challenges is there's no control stick that gives you the ability to make, you know, rational choices in some of these areas. So that was sort of the economic model aspect of it that left me cold. But it is interesting, I think, in that it gives me some things to think about. So that's from that perspective, I'm glad you read it and discussed it. I'm just not sure if you can, or if it was even intended to give you guidance to manage by.
I think it's designed to, it aspires to increase sensitivity of scholars and practitioners to these issues that increasing efficiency can actually be detrimental in the long run, and kind of things like that he outlined and that we mentioned, that maybe it doesn't seem as counterintuitive now, but it almost seems that, at least in the literature that he was responding to, that this is something that isn't immediately obvious, that you need to devote a sizable amount of resources to exploring new knowledge for long-term viability, all the risks notwithstanding. And I think March shows that, and maybe the fact that it's so, one of the achievements of this paper that...
You kind of have to put it in context of the time when it was being written.
In fact, written that long ago, which I think is maybe what's putting us off somewhat.
Well, perhaps, but still, if you think about that, it's over 20 years ago, right? Almost 30. So one of the things I would encourage readers to take a look at, if they can get access to it, is the Levitt and March article from 1988. He references it cites it in the paper, and there's a detailed citation for it in the bibliography. And it talks about organizational learning. And because I have access to university library, I could look it up. And what I think was interesting about that article that I think will help get you some perspective is they summarize. So this is basically 2 years or a year before he submitted this article, where they're talking about what is, maybe not known as right, but they're summarizing what's been written about in organizational science. And I thought, I just kind of glanced through that before the podcast, but I thought that was kind of illuminating. And readers also listeners to the podcast might find it as similarly illuminating.
And that's all for episode 19. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed our discussion and that you found it to be of value. And if you did, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students about us. Also, maybe leave us a positive review on iTunes or wherever else you may be listening to this. These always help both us and new listeners who may want to find us. Next week we bring you the summary of this episode, and the week after that we go back to high reliability organizing with some extremely special guests whom you would not want to miss. So thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you next time here on Talking About Organizations.